Today's Teisho is case 57 in the Bienlu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 57 is entitled Joshu's I Alone Am Holy Throughout Heaven and Earth. Engo's introduction. When you have not penetrated it, it is like silver mountains and iron cliffs. When you have penetrated it, you find you yourself are the silver mountains and iron cliffs. If you ask how to do it, I would say that if you attain realization in the exercise of ki, you will occupy the pinnacle of attainment and will allow not even the holy ones to spy on you. If you cannot do this, see and study the ancients' doings as follows. Main subject. A monk said to Joshu, "It is said the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." Now, what are preferences? Joshu said, "I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth." The monk said, "That's still choice and attachment." Joshu said, "You bumpkin, where are choice and attachment?" The monk was speechless. Okay. Secho's verse, "Deep as the sea, high as the mountains, the flies attempt to face the gale, the ant trying to attack the pillar. Choice and attachment, non-attachment and attachment, a cloth-covered drum that reaches the eaves." So, needless to say, thank you for your excellent practice. Wonderful sitting in this room. Everybody here is clearly making an excellent effort, really doing wonderful work. And people are coming into the Dokusan room and offering presentations in response to the koan that are really powerful and sometimes really just strikingly deep and profound. Wonderful, really wonderful work. So this koan involves a period in Joshu's life when he was wandering around China. So as I've mentioned, Zhaozhou and Nanchuan, Joshu and Nansen were student and teacher. And Joshu was like a teenager, he came to a Chanqi, he came to a Sashin, and he had a Kensho, a deep awakening, a deep opening experience. And he said, after the Kensho experience, he felt like a house whose roof had fallen in. By the way, that's how the Buddha described his own awakening. In the Pali Sutras, he said, there's a beam, the roof beam that holds the roof up. He says the roof beam has broken, and the roof has fallen in. See, and Joshu said, I feel like a house whose roof has fallen in. Ruin, like a ruin, an absolute ruin. And you might think, well, that doesn't sound so good. But what he means is I have been trapped in my small self for 19 years, and suddenly I realize that, there's something much bigger here. And my small self is like a house I have to abandon now or leave behind. And now I'm going to live a different kind of life. And he started looking for people to teach him, and he heard about this Zen teacher, Nansen. And he went to study with Nansen, and they had what in Zen is called karmic compatibility, right? They had a relationship that allowed Nansen allowed Joshu to go through barrier after barrier. And anyway, Nansen was Joshu's teacher for almost 40 years. And then Nansen died, and everybody thought that Joshu would become the abbot of the temple. And to everybody's surprise, he didn't do that. He went out on the road, and I mentioned earlier in the Sesshin that there was this wonderful, I wish it were possible, right? You know, I wish the United States had public Zen temples. And anybody, you know, people are held back from their ability to practice because they don't have the time or the resources. You know, and that's so sad, right? I mean, it's the saddest thing because, in my opinion, awakening is the most important thing, right? We spend a lot on defense, you know, on missiles. I wish we spent something on enlightenment, right? You know, it would be so wonderful. So anyway, China had this system of public temples where anybody who was suddenly unhappy with reality, and suddenly felt, you know, there's something missing here. I don't know what it is, but I've got to find out. You know, could just go, you know, and follow the Buddha's example. You leaving your attachments behind, and setting off on the road to awakening, right? And so basically, Joshu went from one of these public temples to another public temple. For a long period of time, he really didn't settle down until he was quite old. I mentioned earlier that he's supposed to have lived to 120, and late in his life, like in his 90s, he developed the Mu Koan, which is, you know, been this revolutionary practice in the Chan Zen world, right? So anyway, this involves a moment in Joshu's biography when he's traveling around China, and people had heard of, you know, in the Zen world, which was very much by then the Buddhist world. You know, Zen was really the leading sect of Buddhism in China, along with Pure Land. And you know, basically, people knew about Nansen and Joshu. They were like legendary in the Zen world. And anyway, Joshu would be going to these temples, and sometimes people would be so happy to see him. And other people would be puzzled that such a accomplished person was traveling around like a novice monk in an unconventional way. And some people just felt like, I'm going to pop this guy's balloon, you know. They're always such people, right? So they said, you know, he's supposed to be something, but I can see through him. You know, he's a big phony. So that there's a number of koans where that happens, where somebody comes up and sort of tries to push his buttons and see what happens. And in this case, a monk is coming up to challenge Joshu. He says, a monk said to Joshu, it is said the great way is not difficult. In this translation, it says, the great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. Now, what are non-choice and non-attachment? And Joshu says, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. So, you know, that's a very strange thing to say, you know, actually. The Buddha taught the doctrine of anatta, no self. So basically, the Buddha said there isn't an essential self, and that as we struggle to be real, to make the self real, we just cause ourselves and other people endless suffering. And it's easy to see that that's so, right? I mean, my father was somebody who was very, I think, rather poorly treated by his parents. He didn't, his parents didn't treat him in a nurturing way, to say the least, and he never received their approval. His older sister, my aunt, was the A student in the family. She got straight A's all the way through school. And my grandfather and grandmother just loved her. They just, you know, Joan was her name, Joan. She could do no wrong, and my father could do no right. So you know, my father grew up, the way my father compensated was like to be what we would now call like a narcissistic person, you know. So my father had this deep sense of personal injury or like hunger for approval. Dominated his life. Just dominated his life. My father was really deaf to the unhappiness of others. You know, I see as an adult that he was, you know, like spectacularly unobservant of his family, his wife, his kids, because he was constantly struggling, you know, to be seen and to be loved, which are totally, totally normal desires that were never met, and he was always put down. You know, if you have had loving parents, it's, I'm so happy for you, you know. I was reading about this, some of you are probably, maybe you have seen, there used to be a show on television called Happy Days. If you've ever seen that, it may be, that is so old, it may be like, you know, prehistoric. But there was an actor on Happy Days called Fonzie, or Henry Winkler was his name. And his parents, he said, when he was talking about growing up, he says his parents just thought, they used to call him the dumb dog, right? And he grew up with this massive inferiority complex. Well, my father was kind of like that, except I don't think Henry Winkler turned out to be a big narcissist. And you know, my father was just, when he walked into a, you know, there's a lovely saying that Teddy Roosevelt's daughter used to say about him, and it's so true for my father. My father had to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. So when he went into a room, it was like he was working the room, right? It's like no matter what, he's working the room. And you know, his idea was, you know, it was like you, as a child, it's so interesting. When I was about 12, I went to we were on a military base, and I went with my father to pick up the officer in charge of the base. And I was young, but I could see a change in my father that I couldn't understand at the time. But when my father, when the General Archibald got off the plane, my father turned into a different person, you know? It was just like, it was like showtime. And he was performing for the general. And at the time, I didn't have the tools to understand what, but in retrospect, I realized, you know, he was desperate, and he was almost like tap dancing for this guy. It was like, you know, as I grew, you know, in maturity, I realized, you know, that's so sad, right? My father didn't have self-confidence for all kinds of obvious reasons. And the downside was that he was constantly trying to get approval from others, and when they withheld approval, he felt terrible about himself and developed consequently a drinking problem. So, you know, all of this is part, you know, the Buddha would say, of course, right? The Buddha the Buddha would say, you know, basically, this is like how we don't have to be narcissistic, right? But this is kind of, I think, Buddhism thinks, sort of like how the self system works. You know, it's the self system works this way. That it really is looking to others for approval and ratification, right? And it's so nervous about this that it doesn't see the suffering of others. You know, it just doesn't notice. And I don't mean to say that my father was a cruel person. He wasn't. He was a normal human being, but he just was so tone deaf to people's feelings, and he never developed a empathy, powerful empathy, right? You know, we in Buddhism, we've been alerted to this, right? There was a person in the Buddha's Sangha who was the Buddha's cousin. His name was Devadatta, if you've ever heard of. And Devadatta was like, kind of like a narcissist, you know, if you read the Pali Sutras, right? He was constantly trying to be the Buddha's, right-hand person, right? He's trying to be the Buddha's right-hand person. And he became a very bad person when he was not given a position of authority by the Buddha. When he was denied the Buddha's love and attention, he began to hate the Buddha, right? And this is part of, and eventually he tried to assassinate the Buddha. The Buddha was a target of several assassination attempts, and two of them were by his own cousin, Devadatta. And Devadatta had paid some people to lie in wait for the Buddha and kill him. And the Buddha was walking, doing his rounds, and one of the persons came out, and the Buddha had a conversation with him, and the guy was so ashamed, the sutra says, after he was talking to the Buddha for a while, he was in the presence of that amazing non-judgmental compassion. And he started crying, and he said, I've come here to kill you, I'm so ashamed of myself. And the Buddha said, look, we all get trapped in this way, you know, please follow the Dharma. And he said, you need to go away from these people because they will now hurt you. So anyway, you know, the Buddhism has this very strong criticism of the self, which I think is pretty accurate, right? This idea that we don't have any permanent existence. It's not like I get a check from the state of New Jersey every 2 weeks. You know, I'm so happy for that, right? When I go home, if somebody goes, Bill, I don't turn and go, oh, do you mean me? You know, I know I'm Kurt, you know. But on the other hand, you know, there's, if you think about it, you know, even though there are these consistent patterns in your life, you know, you're really not the same person you were. We want to tell a story about ourselves that we're consistently over time the same person. But if you really think about it, even though there are these patterns that sort of go over time, you know, there really isn't a person called Kurt who's consistently present. There's like a series of Kurts, right? That's how it is. There's like a series of Kurts. And actually, you know, I'm the Kurt who made certain decisions is long gone, and I'm here, and I'm making decisions for the Kurt who's going to come. And I'm sending, I even leave notes for myself. It's like, Dear Kurt, you know, this is the Kurt of, you know, June 1st, you know, but on June 12th, please go to the doctor, right? And you read and say, oh, okay, I'll go to the doctor. That's what my predecessor wanted. There's the great Yogacara philosopher Vasubandhu compared the self to like a train of ants, right? You know, each ant is just one, you know, just a couple of brain cells, and each ant is making some decisions, right? So, you know, go left, go right, and the other ants are following that ant, and basically the ants are an organism, you know? The ants together are an organism. And he said the self is really kind of like that. The self is really like that group of ants, right? And each ant is just, you know, maybe one moment in your life, something like that. So there isn't really a permanent self, right? If there were, you know, things would be terrible. We wouldn't be able to adapt to change at all. But we can adapt to change, right? The interesting thing is that precisely because there isn't a enduring permanent self, we can change our lives profoundly and become totally different people. I was fascinated by this story of, you know, Native American people had a practice which just seems totally weird to us. But, this was a big part of their culture. You know, let's say that in my family, my Uncle Bill dies. And, you know, basically what the Native Americans would do is actually, kidnap somebody from another tribe or adopt somebody from another tribe and say, okay, you're Uncle Bill now, right? These are your things, and here, really, and that sounds totally crazy, right? But actually, you know, people learned how to play the role. They became the new Uncle Bill, right? And actually, you know, something like, you know, something like lamas are like this, really, right? I mean, we're taking somebody and we're saying, you are now the new Karmapa, right? And it's not so different from what Native Americans did. You know, the assumption is that you can do this because you don't really have an essential self, right? We think, you know, the story of reincarnation is about the persistence of a permanent self over time. But that's not what the Tibetans believe. They say that's not true. It's like there isn't a persistent eternal self over time. So you know, our culture is so different, it's a little hard for us to appreciate this, but we who do meditation know from our own experience how this is true. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you go into mushin, you know, self-referencing stops. So you have thoughts, but you don't have a thinker at that moment, right? And then the thinker comes in. So, you know, when I'm in mushin, you know, thoughts are coming and going like clouds in the sky. And occasionally I'll have a thought where I think of Kurt, and I'll think, oh, you know, what does Kurt want with his rice today, or something like that, you know, or I'll think, oh, Kurt's leg hurts. But, you know, sometimes I don't even think Kurt's leg hurts. I'm just in deep mushin, and then it's like pain in leg, pain in leg, pain in leg, you know. Ring bell, must ring bell, you know. And but it's not really. And then occasionally I'll remember to be Kurt, right? And you know, we think that the self is the source of thought, but actually the self is produced by thought, by a thought process, and and the self is just produced by that. So what does what could Joshu possibly mean by saying this, right? Joshu says, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. Now look, this is actually not just, this is not really Joshu's phrase. The Buddha is supposed to have said this, right? Actually, when he was, like a little baby. How is the Buddha, teacher of the, as it says in the sutras, teacher to gods and men, right, to gods and humans, how could the Buddha say this if he believes there's no essential self? Let me just change direction a little bit and talk about a sangha, a community. Right? One way to think about a Buddhist community is that there is and this is the way some people think about Buddhist communities, that at the center of the Buddhist community is the teacher, the spiritual virtuoso. Is what they're called in the literature. So there's a spiritual virtuoso at the center of the community, and then there are the people who are like soon to be spiritual virtuosos, and then there are people who are practitioners, and then there are people who are occasional practitioners, and then there are people who are supporters, and then there are people who are admirers, and then there are people who are detractors, right? Okay, so that's the, okay. But I think that model is totally wrong, if I may say so. I think that's still thinking in terms of like, this is still trapped in the model of the self. See, I don't think that any person is the center of a Buddhist community, And I think that the Buddhist community is like, this is totally going to sound a little, I'm not a scientist, so forgive me. Okay. But look, I think a Buddhist community is like an atom, And, atoms have a core, which is, as I recall, like a proton and a neutron. And we have a core at the center of our community. We have three things: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? And I think that that's the core. That's the center of the community. And then basically around the core of the community are like the electrons, electrons. And, all the members of the community are like electrons revolving around Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The thing is that the electrons hold it together, right? The electrons hold it together. And if you don't have the electrons, it all falls apart. So there isn't really a center, there's no self at the center. There's the Dharma, Buddha, and Sangha are at the center. And all of us, all the people here, are like force fields. We're force fields holding the community together. And I think that's a different model. There's no essential self. If you said, well, where's the center of this? The center of the Sangha is Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But if you said, who is at the center of the Sangha? There isn't any person at the center of the Sangha. If you said, well, basically, where is the Sangha? I would say the Sangha is the whole system, right? The whole system. I hope this is, I'm not sure this is making sense, but when we come to Sesshin, it's true. I've been meditating for 50 years. A long time ago, I finished my training with my teacher. But all the same, when we sit together, you know, basically, I benefit greatly from your practice. Your practice is my practice, right? Your practice is my practice. And it's if I practice by myself, it's not the same thing. It's like, it's okay, but when I practice with other people, I experience awakened mind in a totally different way, right? I experience my practice in a totally different way. It's qualitatively different, right? And so I benefit enormously from practicing with you. And my practice is enriched in so many ways. I learn so much from practicing with you. And people come into the Dokusan room and they say things like, they'll give a response to a koan that's just like, you know, brilliant. And I will remember sort of the lame-o answer I gave, you know, 30 years ago, and think, oh my God, why did Genki Roshi even pass me, you know? Sometimes people just nail it. So it's like you are seeing the facts, you're seeing you see clearly through the obstacle, and your perception is so clear. You know, that's whose insight is that? You know, it's yours, and it's mine because you tell it to me, and it's ours, right? And you know, the next time I have a student and I work with them on that koan, I'm much better teaching that koan because I've benefited from your wisdom, you know, your intrinsic wisdom. You know, so you know, if we stop thinking about communities as being, you know, having a person at the center, and we understand that we create, all of us together create the community, that we're all like electrons creating the force field that creates this, you know, in Buddhism we talk about cooperating causes, right? In other words, things only happen because of prior things. You know, the fact is that, you know, Murray Grove is here, right? It's the most wonderful, what a stroke of quote-unquote luck. You know, there's a place where we can practice, right? And it's, you know, it's reasonably, it's affordable. And we get good music on Sunday night, right? You know? And who doesn't love the sound of motorcycles, you know, youthfully, you know, slashing through the night, you know, all that testosterone, it's so great. But this place is like, we need a place, you know, and, you know, we're all here working together. We're all here, all of us, exploring enlightened mind. You know, I've been practicing for almost 50 years. I studied with two very capable teachers, but they didn't know everything. And as I say, you know, sometimes people come into the Dokusan room and it's so eye-opening for me. It's like, man, that is exact. This has happened a couple times in the last few days. Somebody came into the Dokusan room and it was just like, God damn, I might have even said God, I don't think I did, but it was like, that is, you have, thank you, you know, I see this so clearly now, you have helped me so much, you know, I've worked with this koan for 10 or 15 years, and yet, you know, you've just shown me something I never saw in the koan. And how's that possible, right? Well, it's because, you know, you're entering deep mushin, right? And you're exploring this reality from the standpoint of no self. And, you know, you have this insight and you bring it to me. And, you know, it's like we're all on the path. Right? We're all on the path and we all benefit from one. We all have intrinsic wisdom. If we didn't all have intrinsic wisdom, you know, what I'm describing wouldn't be possible. There'd just be clueless beginners and highly accomplished practitioners. But it's really not like that. It's like the universe is vast. We recite the four great vows. And basically we say Buddha knowledge is, the universe is infinite. Human suffering and depravity, you know, ignorance is infinite, you know, beginningless greed, anger, and delusion. That's what the sutras say. And Wei Nong says, yes, it's the humans will be long gone, but our successor sentient beings will be, as because they fall prey to the illusion of a permanent self, will be as destructive as we are, right? But and then it says, Buddha knowledge is infinite. I vow to learn it all for over every lifetime. And then, you know, basically I vow to engage in the rescue of all sentient beings without exception, an infinite task, right? But Buddha knowledge is infinite, right? And we're all like, in a certain way, right? We're all sort of like one mind coming to awakening together. You know, it's true that people as individuals have daikensho, you know, as I can attest from my own experience. But daikensho isn't omnipotence because the universe is infinite. And, you know, basically, there's another koan about a beginner bodhisattva named Momyo, who can accomplish what this great bodhisattva cannot do. Right? And it's because all of us have intrinsic wisdom. And all of us are calling on intrinsic wisdom and we're exploring reality from the standpoint of no self. And this creates a Dharma Dhatu, a place of liberation, right? Murray Grove is a Dharma Dhatu. This is like a giant mandala, right? And in this mandala, all of these people here today are gradually waking up, right? It's like flowers on a tree, and the flowers are starting to open, right? And you can say, well, which is the most important flower, right? It's like, it's the tree, it's not the flower, it's the organism. So, you know, I often say that I do not write the teishos, a process it produces, and that's the truth, so help me. You know, when composers write music, you know, Lenny Kravitz said, I don't write it. I wake up in the morning, it's in my head, and I write it down, and then I get a check every month for money. It's like that, right? We're making ourselves available to enlightened mind together. And that produces wisdom. It produces our wisdom, you know, not my wisdom or your wisdom, our wisdom. You know, awakened, enlightenment, wisdom, these are all like, this is like a system. It's like an atom, right? And when things come together, liberation becomes possible, right? So all of us, you know, everybody at this sesshin is contributing, is drawing on your intrinsic wisdom, and we're creating, we're advancing into enlightened mind together, and we're all in each other's debt. So I think this is what Joshu is talking about, see? You know, in a certain way, there's no such thing as individual enlightenment. There's no such thing. In enlightenment, if you think about the universe, you know, the Buddhist teaching is that all people are going to wake up sooner or later, right? All people are going to wake up sooner or later. That's the teaching. It may take infinite numbers of lifetimes, but you're going to do it sooner. We're all bound for Buddhahood. And, you know, if you think about the universe as like a big ornament, a big organism, rather, you know, it's like, if you could, it's actually like an ornament. If you think of a Christmas tree, right? Have you ever had that Christmas decorations where one of the bulbs is out and the bulbs won't light up, or some of them are out and you have to plug it in and then you have to go through and replace all the bulbs? This is like the universe, right? This is the Christmas tree theory of Buddhism. It's like one by one, each of these lights is going to come on, right? Until the whole tree is illuminated. And, you know, basically that's sort of, one by one, people are all waking up, but it's not individual enlightenment. It's the awakening to our interbeing. Awakening to our interbeing, right? To awaken is to realize there is no self, that we're all interconnected and we're all waking up together. And I think that's what Joshu means. And I think if he were here today, he would say, yes, you're right. That's exactly what I meant. Engo's introduction. When you have not penetrated it, it is like a silver mountain and iron cliffs. When you have penetrated it, you find you yourself are the silver mountains and iron cliffs. If you ask how to do it, I would say that if you attain realization in the exercise of qi, you will occupy the pinnacle of attainment and will allow not even the holy ones to spy on you. If you cannot do this, see and study the ancients' doings as follows. Main subject. A monk said to Joshu, it is said the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Now, what are non-preferences? Joshu said, my enlightenment is your enlightenment. Your enlightenment is my enlightenment. I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. A monk said, that's still choice and attachment. So he's still thinking of individuality is real. And Joshua's saying, no, there isn't such a thing. It isn't even possible to have an individual enlightenment. It's the system that awakens. It's interbeing that awakens. Joshua said, you country bumpkin, where are choice and attachment? The monk was speechless. So he's saying, look at the source of choice and attachment. Is the self the source of choice and attachment, or is it something else? Setra's verse, deep as the sea, high as the mountains, the flies attempt to face the gale, an ant trying to attack a pillar. See, that's individual thinking. Choice and attachment, non-choice and non-attachment, a cloth-covered drum that reaches the eaves.